Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to another episode of Live with the Apollo. Sorry, why would you tell me that? Why would you tell me that, Dave? Sorry, I've just been so busy.
I thought I would have to politely, kindly, and supportively bring up Live at the Apollo. But no, I should have known the PR machine, the self-promotion machine that is Neil Delamere, would not miss the opportunity to say he has done the biggest comedy show in the UK. Live at the Apollo. Cue the applause.
Thank you very much. I'd forgotten I did it, actually. I'm so glad you brought it up. I'm so glad you brought it up. I'm sitting here in a seat I've ripped from the arena itself, from the age-old. It's not a stadium, is it? It's a beautiful theatre of 3,500, 4,000 seats. It was immense.
Can I say a couple of things and ask you a couple of things? Number one is...
Can we actually welcome people to the podcast for a second first?
Don't, yeah.
We welcome to everybody. One. This is called Why Would You Tell Me That? It's a great podcast. He talks, I talk. We discover things about the world we didn't know. We get an expert to back those random opinions up in the second half. Anyway, back to Live with the Apollo.
So first of all, I have to say, Neil, as we've explored in this podcast before, I've never been to see you live.
No, it's an absolute disgrace. One of us is going to die, and in the next few years, I reckon it's going to be soon, actually. I don't know why, I have a haunting feeling, and you'll never have seen me.
Sorry, I'll just put down the stick of butter I'm chewing here. It'll probably be me who dies. I think you might be really good at this comedy game. Okay? So I really enjoyed it. Obviously, I'm a massive fan of yours, as you know. I'm just very busy when it comes to the actual...
Yeah.
Local dates, you know.
Yes, yes.
But the international ones, I'm very proud to be associated with you.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. You're absolutely hilarious. You killed it. Now, look, I've been on stage. I've been part of a comedy show, not stand-up per se, I suppose, but part of a comedy show. And, an entertainment evening, a soiree of humor.
Yeah.
But when you are walking out to 3,000-4,000 people, but more importantly... the BBC cameras.
Yeah.
Like, do you not be bricking it?
No, because you've done it a million times before. Now, the weird one is, I said to my friend, have you got any tips when you do it? She goes, breathe in and hold your breath. And I was like, why? Because you walk under the sign. So the sign comes up.
Yeah.
And all that dry ice is just fired out onto the stage.
Yeah.
And she said that she knew somebody who did it, like their big moment. They've always wanted to do Live with Apollo. Breathed in at the wrong moment, took all the dry ice in. Instead of, hello, the Apollo, just and then spends 2 minutes recovering from that as the audience goes, is this part of the act?
Oh,
is
there
something
no,
wrong with them?
No,
are they
no,
okay?
No.
They film two in one day, and I was on at the very end.
Oh, is that better or worse?
Well, I was given dispensation if I needed to, because if you do two in one day and the audience is there for a long time, and
say it's
very warm. Now, actually, it was great because it wasn't that warm and they were really up for it. But say there's camera delays, say they're in there for two shows or even sometimes three shows, and there can be a degree of lethargy at the end of you know, fair, 4 hours sitting there. So I was given kind of special dispensation. You can MC the gig, if you know what I mean, if you need to. So you can mess around and banter and play with the audience and then start your set if you need to.
If you need to, yeah.
Or you could actually do callbacks as well if you need to, but the callbacks would be cut out of the show, you know, where you refer to somebody else's bit. And but I didn't need to. It was great. I just walked out and that was the crack.
Well, if you haven't seen it, you do just walk out and launch like... This is, I love this about it. It wasn't even a setup. It was not, you were just straight into saying something about WhatsApp. It was just like, bang, here I am. Here's the thing. I absolutely loved it. It was brilliant.
Thank you very much. Hopefully you loved it so much that you get up off your arse to actually go and see.
You don't really have any dates on. Like,
co-host.
Hardly any shows.
70 or 80 date tour. Literally minutes from your house, you lazy bastard.
Go to neildelamere.com/gigs and honestly, go and see him. I've seen him on the telly. He's gassed.
I've added a London date as well. Pleasance, Islington. So have a look at that. So, Dave, listen.
Yeah.
That's enough about that. I mean, you'll be hearing about it for the rest of your life. So, at random intervals. So, it is your turn to bring me something that will wow me in this world, our podcast world, which is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. What do you got for me this week?
Well, as the cool hip street kids would say, I got you. I got you, okay? I've got something amazing for you. In the second half, we're going to be joined by a scientist, a comic, Neil.
Okay.
A musical theatre writer. Her name is Helen Arney. And... I don't know if you've ever met Helen Arney. Obviously, you tour the UK. She's based in the UK. She's going to tell us about the world's first road trip.
The first ever road trip.
The first ever road trip. And it's funny, when I started hearing about this and reading about this and researching this, I realized that I didn't really ever think about the beginnings of road trips and the horseless carriage and all the things that went with this, because I was just like, well, we've always just traveled, whether, you know, we had to go here and we had to go there. And I was like, yeah, but leisure, you know, I'll just get in the car and go.
Sorry, what? We're going with leisure, not leisure.
Oh, leisure, yeah.
Leisure.
Leisure, yeah.
When did you become American?
Well, I don't know. It just sounds like, I think leisure. No, leisure doesn't sound right to me.
Leisure is doing something leisurely, and leisure is leisure centre.
Yeah, I was just about to say, up the road from me here is a leisure centre.
Swimming in a random pool just floats by your head.
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Not that I'm knocking the Portmarnock Sports and Leisure Centre. Great old spot. I'll go there. Anyway, we'll get to that in part two with Helen, okay? And it is...
This isn't... Now, when you say it's the first ever road trip, this is... You see the horseless carriage. Like, this isn't going to be. And then they had to go to Bethlehem, for that was where Joseph's family were registered in the census.
I've waited 5.5 seasons to actually admit that I am, in fact, an evangelical Christian.
And this Catholic.
Whole thing has been to get you and our sizable audience of Live at the Apollo fans to turn to Jesus.
Rampant Catholic. Ubertag is his hashtag. He is Opus Dei. He's actually the person that they based the maddest character of the Da Vinci Code on.
Yeah.
I'm constantly self-flagellating in the corner.
Oh, he's whipping the hole off himself as we speak. You can't see it now, but he's tied a cinch around not only his leg, like your man does in the film, but also full ball sack and other leg. It is spectacular. It's less self-flagellation, more of a sex swing. He is... Rammed, actually, he can't even see this, but he is, during this conversation, has rammed four cacti up his own hole. It's spectacular.
There's actually no point in denying any of this.
He's going to start taking them out.
Yeah.
We're going to play Catholic Kerplunk. It's going to be weird. He'll take out one needle, one of his testicles drop, and that's how you know the rapture is about to happen.
If I deny anything, it'll be the lady doth protest too much, so I'll just let all that slide. And because we're going to be talking about the road trip in part two, I figured in part one I'd ask you a question. What is the difference between a road and a street?
Oh. I would say a road goes between two towns.
Okay.
And a street is within a town.
That's not bad for a top of your head guess off the old...
There's no such thing as... quality road chocolate.
But there is no rocky street bun.
But yeah, all the ones that Jim Henson rejected live on Sesame Road. it's just an encampment. No, I don't know. Okay. What is the difference?
Well, the main difference is, again, I'm actually going to confuse you and me and our listeners for a lot of this part one, okay? Because it's all very confusing. But basically, streets are a destination.
Okay.
And a road is the kind of the direction to the destination. So you would take the Dublin Road to go to O'Connell Street, if that makes sense. And you can apply that across the UK. You can apply it across France. You can pretty much everywhere. Like, I'm sure wherever you are in the UK, there's a London Road.
Yes.
You know, obviously in Roman times, there were loads of Roman roads because all roads lead to Rome. But so the roads are almost directions. The streets were destinations. They were normally in a town, as you said, and lined by residential or commercial buildings on either side.
Okay.
But let's talk about the names of streets, because a lot of the streets were named after businesses, services. So like Baker Street, Mill Road, Church Lane, you know, Brewer's Cross. Like they all make sense because they're landmarks or services or something that that would be familiar to the residents. Then when builders started actually building roads, they just started naming things after themselves. So famously, I mentioned Baker Street there. Famously, the home of Sherlock Holmes in London, Baker Street, has nothing to do with bakeries. It was built by a guy called William Baker, who just went, I shall name this street after my family.
Oh, you gotta love that.
Yeah, that's very good. They can be completely random, though. For example, like the first street I grew up on, which is about four roads over to my right here, is called Lime Tree Avenue. Mm. There are no lime trees on Lime Tree Avenue, and it's not an avenue. So it doesn't make any level of sense. Now, this is where we're really going to get confused. Just go with me on this one for a second. Okay. Right? In the US, and in a lot of cities, but particularly in the US, because they built these grid system streets in cities, streets and avenues run perpendicular to each other.
Right.
Avenues are wider, and they may have trees and buildings. Streets usually only have buildings on either side.
Okay.
Boulevards are wider and usually have trees and a median down the middle.
Okay.
Lanes are smaller streets off streets, and so are ways. A drive is curved and usually follows some natural, you know, could be a mountain or a forest or some kind of park or something. But in Australia, those roads, the drives, are called boulevards. Just to go back to the other thing.
Okay.
A cul-de-sac in Ireland, we know, is effectively a road with no exit. It only has one way in or out, right?
Yeah.
So we call them cul-de-sacs. In the US, they're called places and sometimes called a close.
Okay.
Plazas, if you've ever been to a piazza in Rome or a plaza in Spain, they're squares surrounded by businesses and streets.
Okay.
Back to the US.
Stations in Ireland.
Petrol stations, yes. Yeah. You park on a driveway, but you drive on a parkway.
Ah.
So parkways are roads that cut through parks or surrounded on either side by parklands. Mm. Intersections are junctions that are on the same level, height-wise.
Right.
Interchanges are raised up above.
Oh.
There's one for you.
Okay.
We didn't even get to alleys and crescents. We'll leave them for a minute. But here in Ireland, right, we have our N roads. And our N roads are our national primary roads. And actually, the M's are only part of the N's. I didn't realize this. I thought they were, because M's are for motorways and N's are for the national roads that aren't motorways.
Yeah.
But the M's are all part of the N's. So the M50, the famous ring road around Dublin, is actually called the N50. It's only denoted as the M50 because it's a motorway. But in legislation, it's the N50. So if you're the kind of person like me who likes to give things the proper name, next time someone says, just go around the M50, N50. No, the M50, yeah. N50.
Yeah, no, let's see how that works out for you. I think the taxi driver would throw you out of the taxi at his leisure, Dave.
Possibly so. Then we have a really confusing system in Ireland after that. Like, honestly, I could go into it for hours, but we won't. I'll just very quickly tell you that the N51 to the N99 are the national secondary roads. The regional roads are R100 to R999. The local primaries are L1000 to L4999. They have to be wider than 4 metres. If you're narrower than 4 metres, you're a local secondary road. That's L5000 to L8999. Then for some reason, they skip the whole 9000s and the local tertiary roads go from L10001 to L89999. They're things like cul-de-sacs.
I love the idea that nearly everybody is switched off. Nearly everybody. But the people who haven't are sitting there going, finally, finally, they have come from the random name system in this country. Finally, somebody's speaking truth to power. He's taking on Big Tarmac. This is about getting cat's eyes on the streets, my friend. So what about where the streets have no name now? Can you explain that to me?
Well, actually, I always thought that was New York. Because the streets in New York are numbered, like 11th Street, 15th Street, 1st Avenue, 3rd, whatever. It's not. Apparently, it's Belfast, and it's to do with the Troubles. I was really disappointed when I learned that.
Oh, that's very disappointing. What is the most common street name in the world?
Oh, I've got you. I've got you on this. This is like the best thing in the world, right? Now, yeah. I'm sorry. I have to do US, okay?
Okay.
Because I researched it, and I couldn't find the world. I don't know how to deliver this to you. Okay. The 10th most common street name in the USA is 7th Street.
Well, okay. I mean, if you think that a city or a town or a village is more likely to have 7 streets than 10 streets.
Than 10, yeah.
So the number, the 7, you know, 10th is always going to be 7th, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it gets worse.
Okay.
We'll jump to 8th, which is 6th Street. We'll jump to 6th, which is 5th Street. We'll go to 4th, which is 4th Street. The only one. The only one. The 4th most common street name in the US is 4th Street. Then, the 3rd most common street name in the US is 1st Street. The 2nd is 3rd Street. And the 1st is 2nd Street.
The 1st, the most common.
The most common street name in the US is 2nd Street. And the reason is, that lots of towns have either First Street or Main Street. So it dilutes the First Streets enough to push the First into Third. Park gets in a 5th, Main a 7th, and Oak Street gets in a 9th.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
which I thought was quite interesting. Look, Neil, we are not mature individuals. No. We like to laugh in Ireland at places like Muff, Termonfeckin, Lower Ballocks, in Tyrone, Fanny's Town in Wexford. Yes.
Hacksport.
But in the UK, they outdo us with the street names. We have the, I think we probably win in the weird place names.
Yeah.
But in terms of street names. Yes, exactly. There's so many odd ones.
There's one place called The Rower as well.
The Rower.
It's just called The Rower. I drove into it the other day. It's near New Ross.
There's a place around the corner from between where I live in Portmarnock and Dublin and the airport. There's a place called Baskin. But everybody calls it The Baskin. There's another place near the airport called Knoll, and everybody calls it The Knoll. I have no idea why.
Well, do you sit down for your dinner or the dinner? Irish people put the in front of random things.
I think Culchies do. I don't know why those two places are in Dublin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the two places you pick. You actually undercut your own argument within the same sentence.
I did, I know. Anyway, to the UK very quickly as we wrap up this for the UK street names that made me laugh so hard. And I know we're not, this is lowest common denominator humour here, but I'm here for it.
Yeah, it's our
Titty
podcast.
Titty Hill in West Sussex.
Okay.
Brown Willie in Cornwall.
No.
Yes. These are all real, I swear. Brown Willie.
Okay.
Bitchfield in Lancashire.
Right.
Butthole Lane in Leicestershire. It's true. Cockermouth in Cumbria. Licky End in Worcestershire.
No. Yes. There's no place called Licky End. Imagine addressing an envelope to somebody in Licky End and licking the stamp and then writing down Licky End in an envelope.
Crotch Crescent. Cox in Cornwall, just called Cox. Crotch Crescent.
I live number one, Gusset Lane, Crotch Crescent.
In Bolton, one of my favourite accents in the entire universe in Greater Manchester, Bolton, is a place called Knob End, which is always funny. But Busty View in County Durham might be my favourite of them all.
Oh no, Busty View. Loads of Vikings coming in Busty View. Is that the dick? Busty View. It's near Biker Grove, is it?
Oh, it must be. Sure to God, it must be. Okay, well, look, coming up in a few minutes' time, we will ditch the childish, immature humour.
Yes.
And we will speak to a very qualified lady called Helen Arney, who is a scientist, a comic, and a musical theatre writer, who will tell us all about the world's first ever road trip. And just before we get to her, one more time, live at the Apollo.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
All right, welcome back to part two of Why Would You Tell Me That? And Neil, we are joined now by scientist, comic, musical theatre writer, and one third of the science comedy phenomenon festival of the Spoken Nerd. It's Helen Arney. Helen, hello.
How lovely to be here. This is gorgeous.
And thank you so much for coming on. And I told Neil in part one that we're going to talk about the world's first road trip. And frankly, this story is so brilliant on so many levels. But let's begin at the beginning, which is not the world's first road trip by foot, by horse, by beast of burden of any description. We are talking about a very particular road trip. And so take us back to the beginning. When are we talking?
We're talking about 1888. 5th of August, if you're being really specific.
Let's be specific.
I'm just trying to milk it the way you are milking forms of transport.
Also, he said beast of burden, which by its definition is not you on it. It's carrying something else. But that's fine.
Totally.
And yes, the first long distance internal combustion engine powered road trip.
Yes.
If we're going to be specific, like the podcast I normally do is called A Podcast of Unnecessary Detail. So,
well,
you're in the right place.
Yeah, you're talking to your brothers here. That's for sure. So, yeah, okay. So, 5th of August, 1888, Neil, we're talking about the first road trip. And there are so many things about this road trip that Helen is going to wow us with. But who makes the road trip and where are they going?
Well, this person who made the road trip, They were the first person to make a long distance road trip, and they were also the first joyrider because they made the first long distance internal combustion engine powered road trip in a car that they basically stole. And the story that is spun is that this incredible person, who I keep calling them a person because actually it's a woman, and that's yes. very interesting, was Bertha Benz, who was the wife of Carl Benz. And Benz might be a familiar name from the, you know, Mercedes-Benz car manufacturing business. So Bertha Benz decided to, as the story goes, just take a little trip to her grandmother's house, 6 miles away through the Black Forest, and just left a little note saying, I'm off with two of our children to see Granny. See you next week. And she didn't tell him that she was going to borrow the car that he invented and had been working on it.
Yeah, this isn't like, you know, literally deciding to take the hubby's car while leaving him whatever you usually have. There's only one car in the world. This is the one that she doesn't tell him she takes.
It's the one. It's the Mark III. It's the one that he's been working on. He's been tinkering in his shed for years to try and perfect this thing. I mean, she probably left him like a beast of burden somewhere in the stables, just, you know, the weekend ride. But yeah, he'd been fiddling with this car in the shed for 2 years, and she decided that it was roadworthy, and that she was going to take it to ground. I mean, there's two ways of telling this story. Like, one way is ditzy housewife steals husband's ride, goes to see Granny with two of their kids, and just doesn't really think about the consequences. The next day, they're front page news, and everyone wants one of these amazing cars. The other way of looking at it is Bertha Benz, co-inventor of the car and PR genius, who in a Machiavellian way decided her husband was spending too long in his shed and they needed to get out of debt and sell some of these ludicrous cars that he had been inventing.
Proof of concept. Proof of concept.
Take to the road. Yeah. So there's two ways of spinning this story.
I like the second one. But look, but before we get into the details, Neil, of the actual road trip.
Hold on. She leaves him a note saying, I've taken the car. And by the car, you mean the car for the world.
The car.
Because I know at the time, Daimler's kind of knocking around cars. But as far as I know, Carl Benz is the dude who makes the first car. So she,
I mean,
you know what? When you say she stole it, like, did she hotwire it? Did she put it into second and try and bounce start it? What did she do?
Like, from what I can tell, she basically got like her two sons to push it out the back door, because at this time, like, it's interesting you say, like, at this time cars were basically illegal. They were invented, they existed, but they weren't allowed in a lot of places to go out on the streets, except like under a lot of like very fussy conditions with, you know, people in front and behind walking to make sure that no one got scared or got run over by this 10 mile an hour.
Well, the Vatican called them, like, you know, the devil's vehicles. Like the instruction was to not even cast your eyes on these satanic things that were beginning to appear on roads.
Absolutely. They were police stationed around the Benz house to stop the car from being driven on the road. So Bertha had to like get around that. She couldn't start the engine near the house because someone might hear it. So they got halfway down the road before they could even like crank the thing started. And yeah, just like set off. I mean, it's really interesting because like there have been things that look a bit like cars since like the 1600s, the late 1600s. There's been steam powered cars. Like the first internal combustion engines were about 80 years before, invented simultaneously in France and Switzerland at the same time. Like one was powered by basically powdered mushroom and the other one was powered by hydrogen. In 1881, I know. Like,
that's a big difference. I mean, hydrogen. We're still talking about hydrogen cars now. No one is ordering a pizza al funghi and taking the toppings off because they can't get home.
But powdered like a podium. It's like a fungus, like a kind of fungus-like thing that is incredibly energy intense, and you can burn it like a powder, and it's just amazing for running cars, apparently.
Funnily enough, Neil, the crazy description you've just given us of taking a product and using it to fuel your insane three-wheeled
crazy
three-wheeled, oh, yeah. We'll get to that, three-wheeled transport thing. That's actually not far off where we're going to go with this. But yeah. I think we should pause for a second, though, Helen. We should go back and give Neil and the rest of the audience a little bit of an explainer on Bertha herself. Because, like, we're painting her on, I think, correctly, as this A, PR genius, B, maverick, C, joyrider. Love that. But I think we should give a little bit of background as to who she was, how she hooked up with Carl Benz. Even his chat-up line is incredible, so we'll get to that. But give us a little bit of background on her.
Yeah, so she was a pretty well-off, like upper-middle-class German woman born in like the 1849. So she had a family fortune. She had a good dowry. She had like a wealthy background. But like this is the 1840s, the 1850s. She wasn't automatically going to get an education. She wasn't automatically going to do anything except prepare herself to get married. The most astonishing thing I found out when I was researching Bertha Benz was that in the family Bible, on the day she was born, her father wrote, "Only a girl again." Like,
oh,
just
man.
Another. Like, I've already got some of these. Why would I need another? These are expensive.
Jesus.
They cost a lot of money to palm off on men, and they don't really contribute anything to our family business, right? So I'm
as a father of two daughters, like, I get enough abuse as it is. If I had written something like that on the day before.
The family Bible under your name, like, that wow. I mean, so if that's the environment she was born into, like, wow. So she went out of her way to learn everything that would just defy her father. So she learned engineering. She taught herself from books. She wasn't expected to get an education, so she found one for herself. I think, like, she looked for an escape plan. And the most obvious escape plan for a woman in that environment is to get married, but to get married to someone who will provide the escape plan.
Yeah, well, she met her match, all right, in Carl Benz, but I love where they met and the chat-up line. She was on a train, and she bumped into this man, Carl, and he was on an outing to a monastery. I mean, you know, it's a standard thing to do in the 1860s. and the chat-up line he used for her was genuinely, he told her about his big idea. And this impressed her. And his big idea was a horseless carriage.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being on a train to Sligo or somewhere, and somewhere around Mullingar, a fellow wanders into your carriage, tries to chat you up with talking about and something that he hasn't invented yet. Like, that is... And she went with it. Clearly an open-minded lady.
The 1860s equivalent of, I've got an idea for an app. I'm just waiting for the right investment.
Yeah. Listen, if you want it, I can't say too much, but it's NFTs.
It's in development stage.
It's an NFT of a three-wheeled car. People are, all the crypto guys are really getting involved.
It's going to be huge in Bitcoin, guys. It's really well.
Huge,
but
huge.
Like, I mean, honestly, it's a short step from horseless carriage to horseless marriage. So, you know. Can you tell I'm writing a song about this?
Yes, actually. We do need to explore that. We will, before the end, explore the fact that Helen, all joking aside, is writing a musical about Bertha Benz. This is so
of course
incredible.
It is. Chitty Chitty Benz, it's called. So if they get together and she is minted, is he minted, and do they kind of pool the resources or anything?
Oh, no, he's the ideas man. Yeah, he's really the ideas man. He's like absolute empty pockets, all the ideas in the world. He needs an investor. And that's actually how they start their relationship before they're married. She invests in some of his ludicrous schemes. And some of them, you know, go bankrupt. There's like some kind of mining business or like steel business. And, you know, it just all goes horribly wrong. And she loses loads of her money. But then they get married and all the money is sort of theirs. And what's so interesting is, like, at this time, she the only way she was allowed to invest in his business was by not being married to him, because as soon as she was married, she became his technical property.
Oh, wow.
And therefore property is not allowed to invest
in businesses.
Know,
oh my
god. A kettle can't lend you 50 quid to start your app, I'm afraid.
No.
How did she know it was me, Dave, of the two of us? I clearly have kettle app written across my face.
Well, okay, well, let's go then to the 5th of August, 1888. And Bertha decides that, as you said, and described it beautifully, Helen, that he'd been tinkering in his shed for too long, Carl. Yeah. The ideas guy was full of ideas, but this needed to be put into practice. And look, whether or not she intended this to be this giant PR exercise, it really was, because the perception at that moment, as we said, of cars was distrust, like evil. I mean, there's actually a wonderful short film about the trip she takes that I presume Mercedes-Benz made it. Certainly has their font across it. But a little girl sees her driving through towards the village. She screams, "Witch, witch, there's a witch coming." But that was the perception.
Yeah, absolutely. It was not something that was like welcomed or desired. And people couldn't see the potential of it. They could only see the danger and the way it was disrupting like life, like as they knew it.
It's like when you see a prick on a unicycle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like some prick on a unicycle in the Midlands, in the middle of Dublin, with no reason to be on a unicycle. And you just think, who's this lass?
We're starting to see his colours now, Helen.
I see that. But also, if there's a, someone, if you work for Big Horse, or Big Beast of Burden, I mean, just think about it. Like, entire livelihoods were like maintaining the forms of transport that existed at the time. So, you know, it was steam trains and steam vehicles, but not really on roads. It was all like, it was all animal. And, you know, everyone from your horse owners to your dung shifters were like, we don't want cars because that is literally going to put us out of a job. So there was fear.
And she steps up and she says, right, I'm going to go on this road trip. So she takes the two boys, isn't that right? Two sons?
Yeah, the two oldest children, the two boys. She leaves all the girls behind because after all, they are only girls again.
Yes, only girls again.
This is internalized misogyny. That's what this is. She's fighting against various factors.
It wasn't that. It was she needed her two oldest children and to push the car up hills, because it really, despite cars tinkering, wasn't actually that good. And it only had two seats. Like, it had three wheels, two seats.
And two gears. I'm a bit of a car guy, and Neil is well aware of that. But we're talking, Neil, a massive 2.5 horsepower here. Yeah. In a car, by the way, because one of the things you try and achieve in car is something called a 1-to-1 ratio. So if you can have 1,000 horsepower in 1,000 kilogram car, that's a 1-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's very rare. We're only beginning to achieve that now.
Yeah.
Bertha had 2.5 horsepower in a car that weighed 800 pounds. Okay.
So sorry, there's more people in the car than horsepower of the car.
Yeah. And I really want to paint this picture for you, because I've seen the picture of this, and I presume you have as well, Helen. But you were talking about, like, literally a small bench.
Yeah.
You're talking about a very thin three wheels. Like, they're not, don't be thinking like anything like the modern wheels. Don't even be thinking of some kind of big chunky motorbike wheel. It's like, a 1980s racer bike.
Yeah.
I like a penny farthing. Like,
not far off.
Like a steel, like, you know, Carl had a lot of unused, bankrupted steel hanging around from his previous business venture.
That's why it was so heavy. Yeah.
So it's a mixture between a penny farthing and a three-wheeled
cart. Van. Like, think about it. Like, the cart that would be pulled by a horse.
Yeah.
It's a very similar. So it's got the two wheels on the back, you know, backside.
Yeah.
And then instead of the horse out front, it's got one wheel. It's got an engine. It's got some kind of, you know, starting mechanism.
I can visualize what's in Neil's head. There's no roof.
No.
There's no, it's just a bench on a trike.
You cannot visualize what's in my head, because what's in my head is Del Boy and Jacob Rees-Mogg in the same vehicle that they've come together to design.
Yeah.
And if that was what was in your head, well, wow.
Okay, so she decides to go on this road trip to the mother or the grandmother, maybe the kid's grandmother, her mother, I don't know, whoever. But anyway, she's going to her ma's gaff.
Yeah.
It's 106 kilometers, 66 miles in Brexit. And she's heading that direction. And think about this for a second, Neil.
Yeah.
There's no roads. There's no, the cars don't exist. So there's no one's paved any roads. There's no road signs, because no one makes 100-kilometer journeys. That's insane. You might do it once on a train in your life to go and move away and marry your husband, but you're not, no one's, this is the very first road trip.
So did she say to her sons, where we're going, there are no roads? She actually, would she have said that? Because I've seen possibly that somewhere. Hold on. So there's no, does she bring fuel?
Oh, hang on. I was just about to say, is he gonna touch one of the most important parts of the story? What? Is she bring what?
Fuel.
Beautiful, Helen. Tell him about the fuel.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, this is what's so beautiful about the story. So much went wrong on this journey, and so much could have gone even more wrong. And this could have been something that no one ever found out about if it had been a total failure. But, like, it became this phenomenal news story and this, like, mythical venture because of all of these problems she had to solve along the way, including the fact that, the car had no fuel tank and could hold like a gallon of petrol.
And it wasn't very efficient, Neil. It's not going to go very far on the gallon.
And just like so many things went wrong with this journey that if anyone else was there at the wheel, I say wheel, it wasn't a wheel, it was a stick. There's no steering wheel. It's a stick that you move from side to side. If anyone else was at the stick, then it would have gone really far south. Do you want me to break down the disaster?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I do think the story with the pharmacy is just unbelievable because it now holds such a place in motoring folklore. So, yeah.
This whole journey also birthed the first filling station, the first gas station. So, yeah, that's even a whole subsidiary story that we're barely going to touch on. But yeah, the car barely held any fuel. So at some point she realized, like, we are going to have to refuel at some point. But there's no petrol stations. There's no petrol. Petrol's not being refined for any purpose. So she pops into a pharmacy and is like, what have you got?
what can I fuel a horseless carriage with?
What have you got and how flammable is it? And the nearest thing she had that she could get from a pharmacy was this stuff called Ligroin, which is like a solvent for cleaning stains off your clothes. It's like kind of a dry cleaning solvent.
Yeah.
Or you use it for like staining wood or something. It's like an absolutely horrible, vicious, like kind of
chemical
thing that you get from petrol-y stuff. I'm really showing my chemistry background here. But you buy it in little bottles in the pharmacy. So she just cleaned out the pharmacy, was like, hey, you got any Ligroin? How much have you got? You know, dollars on the table, Deutschmarks on the table.
Yeah.
And went off with like a tray of little tiny bottles and tipped them all into the carburetor and cracked on our way.
And like what's amazing is, as Helen explained, that is now kind of held in esteem as the very first petrol station because it was a pharmacy that sold Ligroin. But the pharmacy's still there.
No!
Yes, it's in a place called Wieslach and it's still there and it's still a pharmacy. An apotheke, as they used to call it in German, or they still do call it in German, but that's what it was. And yeah, that she went in there and had the brainwave of, I've got to fuel it with something. Ligroin might just be flammable enough and terrible enough to actually make this concoction move.
Imagine how they dined out on that as well. Because somebody presumably spotted that business opportunity and there's some old geezer in that filling station going, I remember the day. Oh, she came in and she said, what have you got? I can light. Oh, we laughed. Her clothes were not that dirty. I said, maybe try this Ligroin. She goes, that's not what I'm using it for. That's unbelievable. So she's stopping at pharmacies. Are more pharmacies or just that
everywhere
one?
She has to. Well, that's the very first one. And that is therefore the first filling station. But even things like cooling, like anyone who knows anything about internal combustion engines, you must cool your engine because it gets too hot and it overheats. And if it overheats, it's all going to seize up and die. But there's no cooling system. So she has to stop with the boys at rivers and get water to feed it into the engine. Ditches, public bathhouses, like wherever she can get water on this journey. It's as important as the Ligroin is to keep the thing going.
I just love that idea. She walks in the pharmacy, is like, I'll have a bottle of spring water, a packet of chewing gum, a bag of charcoal, bunch of flowers for my mother, and 200 tiny bottles of Ligurine. And, and I'm like, that's what I buy when I go in a petrol station as well.
Either she's making a Molotov cocktail or she is taking the first road trip and nobody knows this. So if she knew to ask for that, she must have thought ahead that she was going to do that, surely. But she as you said, it does add weight to the idea that she has engineering knowledge and she knows what to do here. So presumably she can fix these problems as they crop up.
Absolutely. And there were so many more problems in this, like the fuel and the water ones are like the real absolute killers. And, you know, they were also, like you say, road testing, proof of concept, showing up exactly what Carl had not thought of when he was sitting in his shed fiddling with his, you know, perfect mechanisms. He hadn't thought far enough in the future to go like, oh, we need to carry fuel, we need to carry water. And then there's all the things that went wrong, like one of the fuel lines got blocked. So she was like, hey, I'm an engineer, anyone can be an engineer, what have I got on me? As engineers think, you know, engineering is basically doing the best you can with what you have available.
MacGyver. We all have to just think MacGyver. Yeah. German female 1880s MacGyver.
But I think any level of engineering is that. You want to build a bridge, what have you got? Like, you want to go to space, what have we got? Like, that's a literal definition of engineering. So she pops out a hat pin and that does the job. I'm thinking, I mean, if it had been a guy, would they have had a hat pin? Would they have
probably
had the tools
not.
For the job?
She'd probably have to break a rib of the smallest child, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Just like the floating rib, he'd be fine. Yeah.
Just a little one.
Just a little
just
one.
Just one you're not going to miss.
Yeah.
What else happened? There was the brakes were made of wood, which was useless, and they wore too smooth, so the brakes stopped working. So she found a cobbler to put leather on them and basically invented brake linings on the fly.
Come on, Neil. Jesus. She invented brake lining. You see, this look, it's the practice. It's the doing. She did it and then realized what people needed.
Yeah. I think my favorite one, though, is like an electrical cable needed some insulation. And this was like a real stopper. If you couldn't fix this, the whole thing was game over.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, I don't have anything elastic on me or anything like, I do. I have my garter. So, you know, just pop off your stocking, pop your little bit of elasticated fabric around your electrical
your
junction.
Wire.
And and you're done. You're off again.
How long is this podcast going to be? Are we going to get to, and then she invented cat's eyes, and then she sent the children away and invented dogging, and then she did donuts in the car park, and she cut and shut the car with another car, and she invented Formula One, the Nürburgring,
well,
and the Hindenburg.
Actually, there is the best punchline to this entire story, which I will absolutely let Helen tell. But after she does the 100-odd kilometer, 66-mile journey to her mother's, Helen, I'm setting you up.
Granny wasn't in.
No! Please tell me Granny hadn't taken the other prototype and gone the other way. Please tell me this isn't the first head-on collision in history. What a terrible and unexpected turn this would have taken.
That's incredible.
Or not turn, that's why they crashed. She wasn't there.
No way.
Isn't that just unbelievable?
And so what did she just turn around and go back? Well, presumably she stayed the night.
She sent a telegram to her husband and said, by the way, I borrowed the car and it's fine. I fixed everything that's wrong with your car. I got a few notes. It needs another gear because we had to get some people to help it get pushed up the hill. So, you know, can you add all these things? Love, Mrs. Benz. And Carl contacted back and said, okay, great, fine. Please bring the car back because it's in an exhibition next week. So you need to get it back and please like let it be in one piece. So he didn't inquire about their health or, you know, how they were or anything. Just like, sure. Just bring the vehicle back.
How long did it take then? If like 60, what's the top speed of this thing, Dave? Do you know?
Oh, 10 miles an hour.
Okay, 10 miles an hour and it's 66 miles.
Sorry, we should say 66 miles is like, you know, as the
crow flies.
As the Mercedes-Benz crow flies. This is not
so
what happened. This was
like a day.
Circuitous. Right. Like, I'm sure it took must have taken a day, at least.
Yeah, a day. They set off before dawn to like, you know, get out of the way of the police. But yeah, they arrived. They arrived within a day, dealing with all of this stuff. And I'm like, I mean, yeah. what a story.
It's so brilliant. And the thing is, it is so successful in terms of PR. This literally changes the world. And this is why we really want to talk about Bertha, because after this, Helen, like the perception of the vehicle, its uses, the practicality, the usefulness of a car, it completely changes overnight.
Yeah. People suddenly realize there is a use to this. There is a purpose to it. Like progress is here and it has three wheels and a stick. And the orders roll in and it becomes the first car of the many cars that had been invented: electric cars, steam cars, mushroom cars, hydrogen cars, like all the different cars that had been invented across the world. This was the one that captured the imagination of the people who wanted to throw money at it and get a car. So yeah, the orders started rolling in and it became the first sort of not mass produced but like commercially available, viable car. And all of the things that Bertha had discovered on the journey, they got incorporated. And it's just so interesting. I feel like the fact that her grandmother wasn't there when they arrived just shouts to me that this was absolutely not to do with visiting her grandmother. This was absolutely to do with telling Carl that, you know, he could spend another 5 years fiddling with this thing. And in those 5 years, someone else would get to the punch before they did.
I have an image of Carol still not understanding, though. I have an image of Carol still not understanding how big PR this is. And he goes out to the papers and goes, any car I make will go 66 miles. Bertha has to drive all of them. So we're going to have to figure out a way to replicate Bertha. But cloning can only be around the corner because we have a three-wheeled car. I think I've understood the PR success of this, Bertha. And Bertha's like, hand me the other hat pin. I'm going to take over the business.
I mean, how much of a change would that be? It'd be like, right, well, clearly only women can drive these things.
Yeah.
Like, what a change that would have been. I mean, how quickly it fell back into like the standard procedure.
So how is she? I actually haven't heard of Bertha Benz, much to my shame, until Dave is bringing this to me. Is she remembered? Do Mercedes Benz love her? Do, you know, can you drive the route? Is it like the, you know, isn't it the Gordon Bennett route you can drive around Ireland?
Absolutely. Like, there is a Bertha Benz memorial route, and it is like between Fort Simon, Mannheim, the place where they lived and the place where Granny lived. And you can drive in. There's like an annual shindig where people bring out old cars, not all that old, but like there's like the London to Brighton. People get their old cars out and do this journey. Like that's one thing that's kind of celebrated about it today. This is one of the reasons this story is so well painted and so detailed, but also so like problematic, is you read all these histories about Bertha Benz and what she did in her like 30s with this car journey. And then you start reading further into the biographies and you come to a bit where it says, you know, she was finally recognized for her contribution to engineering in the year 1944, where she was awarded a honorary degree from this technical university in like Berlin. And I'm just gonna say that and let you put two and two together. 1944,
yeah. Okay.
Berlin.
Not the greatest German government to be recognized by,
who's giving her the honorary degree? It's Hitler. Right. So, like, wow. Yeah. She was in her mid-90s at the time, and she died before the end of the year. Like, you know, there's an argument that she kind of didn't really get what was going on. There's another argument that she was a not unenthusiastic supporter of the Nazi Party, of course, Mercedes-Benz being the vehicle of choice for Hitler. And what's kind of really made this story so muddy, and that's why it's made it so interesting for me, is that this story was used as German propaganda, and she was taken, her story was taken and used by the Nazi regime to like extol the virtues of German women. And Bertha was like, you know, the mother of German ingenuity. And she was repainted in all this propaganda as this extraordinary woman who did this extraordinary thing, but in service to the Nazi regime. So yeah, it's really challenging to retell this story when you know that someone else has retold this story in a way that I find abhorrent.
And that's why you're writing a musical about Bertha, to retell this story, and particularly this road trip.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a story that needs to be released from its history, but not leave its history behind.
Fair, fair.
Yeah, I suppose it did happen in 1888, and she becomes a fervent Nazi, if she is indeed a fervent Nazi, in the late 1930s and mid-1940s.
It's a story that comes with a lot of baggage in a way that the Mark III Carl Benz Motorwagen did not come with baggage, because there was no room for baggage. Like, the baggage...
There was no sizable trunk.
No, there was no baggage. They had no baggage because there was no room for baggage. And yet, like, the baggage has been added later. And I just find this so, like, fascinating that, you know, like, women in history, especially when they're given a platform where their stories are told, like, it's really hard to find stories where women are allowed to be complicated and wrong about stuff. Mm. Like, you don't know if it, I haven't seen it, but like Oppenheimer, you sit in the cinema for 3 hours, like, with a guy who was wrong about things and right about things. And that kind of quantum physics of being both right and wrong about stuff at the same time is like, that's 3 hours of reveling in that juxtaposition of those two ideas. Whereas most, like, biopics about women in science or women in history are like, well, they were either one thing or another, and that's like it.
Yeah, that role is painted, yeah.
Dave, did I tell you I saw Oppenheimer, and somebody invited me to the premiere of it, and I was with Keith Barry, who was beside me. So I may have seen Oppenheimer, or I may think that I have seen Oppenheimer.
To any of our listeners who don't know, Keith Barry is a mentalist who may well control Neil's mind to this point.
I mean,
Neil, in fact, maybe you're still in the cinema watching Oppenheimer and you think you're doing a podcast months later.
Which is what Christopher Nolan would want, because if there's anybody who would absolutely fuck with your mind, it's Christopher Nolan.
I think
Christopher Nolan should come out at the start of films and just go, "You all have already seen this film," and then just go home. Because that is essentially what I feel like every time I watch one of these films. But this has been much more understandable on many levels.
It has. And Helen, please plug a couple of things. Tell everybody what the Festival of the Spoken Nerd is, for a start.
Oh my gosh. That's a show I've been doing for about 15 years with a guy called Matt Parker, who's the UK's finest stand-up mathematician / only stand-up mathematician. It's a very strong field of one. And a guy called Steve Mould, who used to do the experiments on Blue Peter and won't stop going on about it. And we do a show together, which is like a science comedy variety night. And we're still doing them. We're doing some big shows in London later this year. We also have a podcast called A Podcast of Unnecessary Detail.
Link to all of these things in the show notes. Please go and listen and look and attend.
If I ever finish this song from the Bertha Benz musical, then it will be on that podcast. So, you know,
amazing.
Go check it out.
Helen Arney, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us all the story of Bertha Benz. It is much appreciated.
Thanks, Helen.
Thank you.
Welcome back to part 3 of Why Would You Tell Me That with me, Dave Moore, him, Neil Delamere, and that was Helen Arney telling us about Bertha Benz. What do you think of that, Neil?
Oh, that was class. What a woman.
Seriously.
I'm going to sort this out. I have a PR brain. You are clearly tinkering around with an engine, and I am going to sort this out. Not only am I going to fix stuff with random bits, random accoutrements, hat pins and all the rest, but I'm also going to set up accidentally the first ever petrol station.
Yeah.
That's
and my favourite sentence in the whole thing was, she took the car. Not like the way we say that is in, oh, my missus took the car, I can't play golf. She took
the only car there was, she took it. Yeah, had to outrun the police to get out of the place.
Yeah.
Oh, what a hero. And Helen was brilliant.
Yeah, she was absolutely brilliant. I can't believe I haven't heard that story. But I know. That is the exact thing that you want to see at the end of an episode of Why Would You Tell Me That? I can't believe I didn't know that story.
Right, well, you can wow me next week with a story that I undoubtedly haven't heard. What are you going to tell me about?
What is the most famous national park in the world, do you think?
Yosemite? Oh, Yellowstone.
It's Yellowstone. It's widely considered to be the first, certainly in America. And we're going to talk to a research scientist called Kira Cassidy from Yellowstone. And she's going to explain, you know, that whole alpha wolf thing.
Yeah.
Alpha wolves. And people use alpha wolves to justify all sorts of alpha male behavior in humans.
Yeah.
Nonsense.
What?
Yeah. It's nonsense. And she's going to explain exactly why next week.
Excellent. I can't wait. Right. Follow Neil Delamere on Instagram at Neil Delamere Comedy. I'm at Dave Today FM. The show is at Why Would You Tell Me That? And we'll see you next time.
Bye. I'm going to drive in the N50 home now.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.